Good morning, everybody. My name is Paul Santa Maria, and I'm a member of the redoubtable Michael Green's list. And I'd like to welcome you to this CPD session this morning on negotiating and drafting settlement agreements, principles and content. And the session is one of the apparently endless sessions offered by Green's List barristers. And I have the privilege this morning of introducing David Bailey on my right to those of you who don't already know him. I don't think there'd be too many in that category. As before coming to the bar, David had enjoyed a distinguished career with a national reputation for some 30 years or so as a leading Melbourne solicitor specialising in banking and finance. His profile is published in our papers, and so I'm not going to read it out to you. But there are a couple of aspects of his career that aren't included in the profile, and one aspect in particular I'd like to mention because it was of such significance to me and to countless other junior counsel intent on establishing a practice. And that was this. With the late Associate Justice Ewan Evans, David was co-editor of Williams Supreme Court Practice for more than 10 years to 1986. And the two of them co-authored a book entitled Discovery and Interrogatories Australia, from its first two editions in 1984 and 1990 into the loose leaf publication. And starting at the bar, I purchased only a couple of books. One was the English text, Anson's Law of Contract, which I still think is pretty hard to beat. The other book was David's book on discovery. And it was simply unbeatable. And I carried it in my bag for years while tramping around chambers in the practice court doing interlocutory work, and I certainly never came across anything better. If it were possible for me to claim some credit in conceiving the topic of this morning's seminar, I would of course do so. Unfortunately, I can't. I'd like to claim the credit because the topic that we're going to examine with David this morning is one which is vitally important, I think, in the discharge of our obligations to, as legal advisers to our clients. It's so often the case that much energy and anxiety and financial and emotional capital is expended by clients working up to a trial, and then the basis of an acceptable compromise of a claim or defence is arrived at. To the client, arriving at the compromise suggests that all pain and disagreement is then behind them, only to become disillusioned by the next phase, the negotiation of terms of settlement and like agreements. And I suspect we've all had the experience at one time or another of spending just as much time negotiating the terms as was spent negotiating the actual compromise. It can be exasperating, but it is critical to get it right. Herein lies the problem. The documentation of a settlement does not always command the same endeavours as the negotiation of that settlement. And that might come about because of a variety of factors. Some clients will have been thoroughly disaffected by the whole process and just want to leave. They don't understand or appreciate the risks to them of an unsatisfactory settlement document, so that the existing dispute is simply replaced in due course by another dispute if the settlement document is unsatisfactory. And I think clients can impose perhaps unreasonable burdens or pressure upon their own lawyers, or we witness the criticism of opposing lawyers whom our clients regard as being too finicky. Another factor is that some lawyers don't have a sufficiently sophisticated understanding of the principles of law underpinning settlements. And speaking for myself, I've always run for cover or wanted to reach for a gun when someone pipes up about a court and satisfaction or worse still, a mere accord executory. But the truth is that one does need to know about these things, and the number of cases involving barristers and solicitors being sued for errors made through ignorance of the area is testimony to the fact that we don't know enough about the area. There's also the fear, often well grounded, that unless the lawyers move quickly to have the terms of settlement signed, the other party may change its mind and disavow the settlement achieved on an in-principle basis. And the truth is that in a good number of cases, good lawyering requires the barrister or solicitor to say, stop. The task of documenting the settlement can't be rushed. It may require the parties to be sent home so that the drafting process may be undertaken with all due speed, but with appropriate thought and consideration. So that in some cases, in order to protect one's own client and preserve the bargain negotiated, one might have to stand up to the client, or more often, to the opposing side. David addresses this type of situation in his paper and touches on the topic of how the essential terms of an agreement may be recorded, allowing a more detailed agreement to be prepared later. But in this area, it's simply not worth taking unnecessary risks, and the drafting of an enforceable agreement requires knowledge of the law, caution, and experience in equal measure. I've had the considerable advantage of reading David's seminar paper earlier this week. It's a great survey of the legal principles governing the structuring of settlement agreements and the rules governing the enforcement of such agreements. All of this informed by David's substantial experience and his gift of clarity. So I'd ask you to welcome David Bailey.
Thank you, Paul, very much for those warm words of welcome. It's a bit like hearing your life story, hearing all that. But I was reminded this morning of the phases of life of a lawyer, and I had this nightmare that in my dotage I would sleep through comfortably this morning's seminar and be reminded by my clerk at about 11 o'clock that I was supposed to be here delivering this paper. It's a bit like when we start off as lawyers at law school and we have that recurring nightmare about missing the torts exam and being rung up by the best friend at about 11 o'clock saying, David, where were you? We were all the torts exam. So I'm pleased to say the nightmare didn't come to pass this morning, but anyway, there we are. Paul, I think, has underlined some of the important reasons for getting settlements right. This paper started off about a year ago when I was asked to talk about drafting settlement agreements by a group of solicitors, and I thought, goodness, a bit brave asking a barrister to talk to solicitors about drafting, because it seems to me it's something where, as barristers, we tend to come in later on and try and patch up the pieces that go wrong from drafting rather than trying to draft things up front. But anyway, that's just it started off that way, but it's grown up a bit like Topsy as I've come across newer cases that illustrate different points. So if it is a bit disparate, I apologise for that, but I think I've just tried to cover the things that occurred to me as being of some importance. Start off with the proposition that we're in an environment now where we're being encouraged by legislatures and rules committees and conferences to try and resolve disputes before issuing proceedings. And that, of course, had an iteration in the Civil Procedure Act, which was removed shortly before it came into operation last year by the new government. But that, in the federal sphere, of course, the Civil Disputes Act, I think it's called, required, in at least in federal courts, that you now have to file a certificate that there have been attempts to resolve the dispute before issue of the proceedings, except where an exception applies. So that this focus, this sort of front-end focus, I think makes us all much more aware of the need to explore the possibility of settlement. Maybe, of course, early on, you can't do that effectively because all the issues won't be exposed. You may not, if you're a defendant in particular, you may not be able to fully understand where the plaintiff is coming from. All those sorts of considerations come to play. But nevertheless, I think it just puts us under an added responsibility early on to be as fully prepared as we can be. I think in the past, when you were able to simply plead defences that traversed, you can't do that now under the new rules, so that the encouragement is there to do all you can to be on top of your case early on. So that's the by way of preliminary observation. The other preliminary observation I make is that, of course, settlement rests in contract, so that all the ordinary contractual principles apply. And you need to bear that in mind as the various phases go through, because, as Paul reminded us a moment ago, one may think that a deal's been achieved in principle, and everybody gets that warm, glowing feeling at about 2:30 in the afternoon, maybe, that terrific, we've mediated this dispute, we've got a settlement. Everybody goes away without perhaps thinking through the terms, and then the next day it starts to unravel because everybody has second thoughts, or one party in particular has second thoughts, and then they try to renegotiate the situation. Time always is the problem here. I've had a recent dispute where it's actually the agreement in principle was on Christmas Eve pretty much, and that was fine, and the party circulated terms of settlement, and the opposite party didn't respond and took about 7 weeks to come back with their version of the terms of settlement, but by which time my client had formed a totally different view of the situation. So, you know, time becomes a bit of an enemy when you start to drag out the settlement itself in principle with the conclusion of the terms. So passing from that observation that as to the need to get the contract in place, one also sees that similar considerations arise as would apply to contracts where a party may later say that they didn't really understand what they were doing when they entered into the settlement, or they refer to some alleged unconscionable dealing or conduct on the part of the other party. And I've given you a reference to a case of Collar and National Australia Bank, in which there was a mediation and a consent to terms, and on a default basis, if the terms weren't satisfied, the bank had the right to enter judgment. So a typical sort of enforcement of a mortgage debt, or debt secured by a mortgage, and what happened was that there was a default in the terms and the bank entered judgment, and the hapless former mortgagor of the bank, probably still a mortgagor at that point, sought to set aside the judgment on the basis that when the terms were entered into, Ms. Collar was acting under some mental condition, and also that the bank had taken surreptitious or unconscientious advantage of her condition, that she was under... She was unable to judge or properly judge for herself by reason of weakness, inexperience, necessity, ignorance, and so forth, and the bank had taken advantage of that. Well, the matter was run before Associate Justice Daly, who delivered a well-reasoned judgment, which is reported, and Her Honour considered that on the evidence Ms. Collar led, that the matter simply didn't get up. But what I think the case reminds us of is that there will be cases where one is acting for I don't intend any disrespect, but you so-called little people, in quotation marks, people who don't are not professional litigators. It's the one big dispute in their lives. They're under enormous stress and pressure, and I think there's a special obligation on us in those circumstances to ensure that they fully understand what is going on. Banks, of course, include usually in their terms of settlement familiar clause that says that the party acknowledges that they had independent legal advice and all this sort of thing when they signed the agreement, or they're fully aware of all material facts. Those sorts of motherhood type clauses, which can stand in the way of, I suppose, setting aside the agreement. You could still do it, but obviously one would need to have fairly strong evidence to rebut the presumption that might be created by those sorts of provisions. So from there, I'll get into the paper proper, and I start off by talking about call to bank offers, which have become one of those processes that very frequently used these days. And just to sound a few words of warning, and that is that there's no really fail-safe way of drafting a call-to-bank offer which will be completely bulletproof. In my view of the current cases, and I've read an awful lot of them the last few years in doing my annotations for a certain red book, The title Call to Bank and Call to Bank came from an English family law case, and it's become enshrined in the legal fabric. The basic concept is simply that if a reasonable offer of settlement is made and unreasonably rejected, then the offeror should be able to obtain some advantage in terms of a costs penalty against the other party from the date the offer is made. So the properly made call to bank offer, let's say maybe halfway through a proceeding after pleadings and discovery, parties know their cases, call to bank offer is properly made, then it ought to carry a lot of weight. Now that's true, but there are a few reservations, and there have been rejections of call-to-bank offers where the courts have said, well, in all the circumstances, the rejection was not unreasonable, so we're not going to impose any cost penalty. Well, what are those considerations that the courts have regard to? The leading case like these days is still Hazeldene's Chicken Farm. And I like that anyway, because it's a catchy sort of title that you don't forget. Against the Victorian Work Cover Authority number 2. I've got all the citations of these cases in the paper, so I won't go into them. It's a Court of Appeal decision, and the court, while making it clear that it wasn't laying down any factors in concrete, said that there are a number of circumstances that courts would have regard to in considering whether a call to bank offer was reasonable. Or been unreasonably rejected, I suppose. And one of the important ones is the stage of the proceeding at which the offer was received. For example, if the offer's made too early before you as the offeree receive it, you think, well, I don't really know enough about the other side's case yet. We still think we've got a pretty good case. And you may reject the offer. A rejection in those circumstances might be regarded as quite reasonable. So that when it's made early, then you've really got to perhaps consider if the offer should set out detail about why you reckon it's a good time for the other side to settle. The other factor is a bit more straightforward. For example, the time allowed to the offeree to consider the offer. Now, again, this will depend a bit on the time of the stage of the proceeding when the offer's made, because once the trial starts, for example, it might not be unreasonable to make a call-to-bank offer giving the other side 24 hours to consider. because of the fact that trial is running, costs are being incurred at an escalating rate, daily basis, and one would think that both parties know their cases, then you don't need an awfully long time to consider whether an offer is reasonable. But at an earlier stage of the proceeding, well, give the other side a bit more time, give them maybe 2-3 weeks, whatever is a reasonable time for the client to get advice, to consider the offer, to consider all the circumstances. Another matter identified by the Court of Appeal was the offeree's prospects of success at the time of the offer. Now, prospects of success, I liken barristers a bit like real estate agents that tell you, I'm going to get a great price for your property when they sign you up. But on the day of the auction, they say, oh, it's a pretty bad market. I think we'd better drop the reserve price down a bit. And you get this, I call that real estate agent creep, but there's also an expression known as barrister creep. When early on in the proceeding, you may think you've got a fantastic case, and you say, well, when asked to opine as to what the chances might be, you say, well, perhaps 65, 70%. Of course, as the discovery unfolds and a few other things happen, and perhaps a couple of witnesses that you were promised by the client don't come up to what you think they might be able to say, and you then ask again to assess, perhaps just as the trial preparation commences, you say, well, I think our chances are down to 50%. And of course, the day before trial, you may have a different view again. So that consideration of prospects of success is one which is a bit flexible and you need to look at very carefully. Another one which I think is very important is the clarity with which the terms of the offer were expressed. And we see in some cases where there's a bit of lack of clarity about whether costs are included or costs on what basis or whether interest is included and for what period. They seem like simple matters, but sometimes in the heat of drafting up the offer, those sorts of things can be neglected. So it's not a bad idea to have these matters I've dot pointed here under Hazeldine's case as a bit of a checklist when you are drafting up a call to bank offer. And the final one is, of course, and I think it's the mantra for a call to bank offer, which is that it warns the other party that if the offer is unreasonably rejected, then you would apply for indemnity costs in the proceeding if the at an appropriate stage. Now, as I point out in the paper, there's a huge number of cases. It's almost become a jurisprudence all of its own, call to bank offers. And I've just picked out a selection of some of the cases to illustrate some of these points. The decision of Justice Finkelstein, as he then was, in BHP Freight, and Freight against Costco Oceania Chartering, where you'd imagine in case of that nature, a couple of large commercial parties, but the call to bank offer was unclear as to the rate of interest involved. And for that reason, His Honour considered that it was not capable of imposing a risk on the other side for being rejected. Another one is, and this is a case I had a couple of years ago, the offer doesn't involve a real or genuine element of compromise, the overseas Chinese banking case. You're all ready to go to trial. You're about a week away from trial. You get the call to bank offer, which is a fairly derisory offer, and it's rejected. And of course, the other side, they win at trial and they produce this letter. And the question then is, well, you were ready for trial, you'd incurred all those costs, you're committed to running. A derisory offer at that late stage may be regarded as unreasonable or certainly reasonably rejected by the recipient, which was a case that I had, and I was fortunately able to persuade the judge that the offer was reasonably rejected at that point. Now the next point which I think is important with all these settlement offers and consideration of offers is whether the offeree is in possession of material facts, which all the facts which are relevant to the decision-making process. And it keeps coming up in various decisions, as we'll see, when you are considering settlement, because if you're unaware of some important point which you ought to know about, then if you reject the offer in those circumstances, it can hardly be an unreasonable rejection. And there's another, the flip side to this is that if the offeror knows about some important fact, which is a good reason why the offeree should accept, then the Call to Bank offer should set that out. And it flows into my next reference, which was the Duke Master case, where if you simply baldly assert that you're going to win and the offeree is going to lose, that's not really doing justice to that point. You should go to the trouble of saying why you think the offeree's case is weak. And if you've got a witness who is going to tear their case apart, well, you should say, look, Mr. So-and-so is going to say X, or we have strong evidence on this ground. We're prepared to show you the basis we support that on, just so that you're making it quite clear that you think their case is hopeless at that particular point for very good reason. The last point I refer to, of course, is I think it goes without saying, if the offer's only open for a very short time, then obviously that also goes into the balance as not being reasonably made. Now, passing on from call to banks to another matter which uses that rather arcane technology of accords and accords executory and so on, what does all that mean? I think it's very important to understand that there are these different types of settlement. And I set them out very briefly in the paper. An accord executory is simply where the deal is done, but the settlement doesn't take place or the cause of action doesn't disappear until the performance takes place. So that it's not really a fully enforceable agreement, as I think it's explained in the case I refer to in a moment, the decision of Justice of Appeal, or judgment of Justice of Appeal, Phillips. So that, if you like, it's a sort of preliminary arrangement to settle, as opposed to the so-called accord and satisfaction. Now, what's that? An accord and satisfaction is an immediate binding agreement which replaces the original cause of action. So in other words, you say, well, I've got a cause of action against you in contract. That goes away and we replace that with you're going to pay me $500,000 on a date certain, so that if there's default in that obligation, you can't go back to your original cause of action. You must sue on the new agreement to pay the $500,000. That may or may not be a good thing, and you've got to think that through, because the cause of action might have underlying rights, perhaps to enforce a mortgage or have some strong bargaining chip, whereas a replacement with simply a right to sue or obtain judgment may be not quite such a good right if things go wrong. So you just need to think that through. The other form of accord and satisfaction is perhaps the one that we're more familiar with in practice, called the accord and conditional satisfaction. And it sort of sits between the two previous ones in this way, that it does replace the original cause of action, but only if certain conditions are satisfied, so that in that way, you can say, well, upon payment of the sum of $500,000, there'll be a release and the cause of action, there'll be a discontinuance entered, and therefore all disappears. But until the payment is made, the original cause of action stays on foot. And I think that's the more familiar way that one sees settlement agreements operating. Now, I've given you the oft-quoted quote of Phillips JA and Osborne and McDermott on page 8 of the paper. I won't read it out. But I do make the observation that it's not always easy to work out whether you have an accord and satisfaction or an accord and conditional satisfaction. That's why it's worth thinking about it, because it does give rise to litigation if it's unclear. And I've given you reference to a Western Australian case of Scafidi and Perpetual Trustees, where there was a huge controversy about the way the document operated. In fact, it was held ultimately by the court that it was an accord and conditional satisfaction, so that the original cause of action remained. But one wants to try and avoid that situation arising. So bear that in mind. Do you want to get rid of the original cause of action, or do you want to maintain it with some right to reinstate, et cetera, et cetera? Now, the other creature that we come across sometimes is so-called covenant not to sue. What does that mean? It's important sometimes to ensure that the cause of action is not discharged by terms of settlement where you particularly want to continue claims against other parties. This is particularly so in my old stamping ground of banking law, where a bank might be suing a number of co-sureties or co-debtors, and one of them's keen to settle early if they can, and the bank's quite happy to get some money early on and get rid of one of the parties. It's important in that situation to make sure that the release of one doesn't release the others against whom the proceeding might continue. There's quite a lot of case law on this. And when you're drafting your terms of settlement with that particular party, one way of avoiding the problem of releasing the co-sureties would be to simply give the first party you settle with a covenant not to sue, because that doesn't get rid of the original cause of action. If you want to make doubly sure, you also expressly say you reserve your rights against the other parties. Even though they're not parties to that settlement, the expression of the reservation of rights is important to just ensure that your intention is made clear. Now, there's an interesting recent illustration of some of these problems of how you express the terms of settlement so as not to release somebody. A decision of Justice Kairu, Associated Retailers and Toys Unlimited, where His Honour had to pick through very complex terms of settlement, found that, in fact, as against certain parties, they operated as a release. And another part of it, there was a reservation of rights. But it wasn't all that clear, and I think that the learning from that case is that it doesn't matter at what level you're operating on. You have a complex agreement with a number of parties. You've got to think through, are you releasing X from all the obligations? You're reserving rights to sue somebody else later on who might be a co-debtor. And in these days, of course, of the proportionate liability, I think these issues become even more important, so that one needs to just think through how you're going to reserve rights if you need to. I've given you the facts of a case called National Australia Bank and Pollack, which I think illustrates the problem quite nicely. There were two judgment debtors, heads of agreement were entered into, and the first heads of agreement actually didn't deal with what the situation was in relation to another debtor, Dr. Pollack. I think what happened was, before the terms were carried out, was a conditional accord and satisfaction. Sorry, accord and conditional satisfaction. Before the conditions could be satisfied, someone's obviously woken up to the fact that there were no words of reservation of rights, so that there was a variation agreement entered into, to amend the deed by saying nothing in this heads of agreement affects the bank's rights against Dr. Pollack or Mrs. Pollack and certain other parties. The parties to that deed, the Stearns, then acknowledged that the bank expressly reserved all of its rights against Dr. Pollack and Mrs. Pollack. Well, then, after this was done, the bank then sought to sequestrate Dr. Pollack. And of course, the argument that Dr. Pollack raised was, oh, he'd been released by this earlier deal with the Stearns. And the Justice Majorick of the Federal Court held that the HOA did not release Dr. Pollack in the first instance, when it was first done, because it was not an accord and satisfaction, but an accord and conditional satisfaction. And then he held that before the HOA could become an accord and satisfaction complete, conditions had to be performed, which hadn't yet been performed, and that at that stage, the variation agreement was entered into, which reserved the rights against Dr. Pollack. So you can see that that was a near miss. But because of the amendment, the bank's rights against Dr. Pollack were reserved and held to be enforceable against him. Now, the last part of this analysis of the way settlements might work when you have several parties has recently come to the fore in another way. I think you're all familiar with the recent environmental problems out in the city of Casey, which gave rise to a large amount of litigation under the name of Willahan and the city of Casey. And what happened there was that there was a settlement between the city of Casey and one lot of defendants, as a result of which the city of Casey accepted liability. But then what it sought to do was turn around and recover against co-defendants monies which it had agreed to pay out to the ratepayers. So what it had to do was to say, or to prove in its proceeding against the co-defendants, that the settlement it had achieved in the proceeding, which was a group proceeding, was a reasonable settlement, because that's part of the cause of action. And the court analysed the way that that must be pleaded and particularised in some detail, and referred to High Court case of Unity Insurance Brokers against Rocco Pisano, where the High Court has set out very well the principles that apply where you are suing to recover monies you've agreed to pay out under a settlement, the need to be able to prove that, because you've got to be able to establish that the settlement was reasonable in all the circumstances. And that might include matters such as the negotiations, the reasoning which led to the settlement, the legal advice that you might have got which suggested a settlement was a good thing, and other matters which were taken into account in deciding whether to settle. So that, an important area, and the importance of it's underlined by another recent case of which arose out of the Olympic Dam constructions. BHP Billiton was involved in a dispute with a German supplier, Stoiler Industriewerk. What happened there was that one of the contractors that had been involved in the settlement tried to sue the German supplier, I think from recollection, and Justice Habersberger held that they had not put on sufficient evidence about the reasonableness of the terms of settlement, and therefore that claim failed. So that you've got, I think, an opportunity with those recent cases just to see how you need to establish those matters to underpin whether a settlement's reasonable so you can recover against somebody else.